Good evening, everyone. We have a rather lengthy Torah portion this week. It's the Torah portion Kisisa, which begins it's chapter 30, verse number 11, and the Chumash we're using, the Zapristin Chumash and Rashi, you'll find this on page 424. As I said, it's a rather lengthy Torah portion, but at the same time, it seems to lack a certain amount of balance. It seems to be, in fact, a bit lopsided. And what I mean to say is the first two aliyot, the first two readings, we know there are seven aliyot, and the Torah portion is divided into seven different sections. The first two sections are very lengthy, and the other five are not. And the reason that is given for this is that the second section that we read is a lengthy section dealing with the story, the unfortunate story of the building of the golden calf. As we know, Moshe goes up, and before he gets down, the Jews are afraid that Moshe has passed away, and they build the golden calf. And Moshe then will instruct the Levim. He says, "Mi l'Hashem alai," who is going to fight for God's sake? And the only ones who gather around him to fight for God's sake will be the Levim. And there is this belief that we have, I wouldn't call it a belief, but there is this Masorah, this tradition that we have, that when a person receives an aliyah, that aliyah can impact you. What you're reading can impact you. For instance, there's a custom, there are two Torah portions which contain what is called the Tochacha. Tochacha deals with the curses that God says when the Jews will stray away from Judaism, from Torah Mitzvos, then they will be hurt, they will be punished. And that's in the Chukosai, it's in Kisavo, those two places. And the custom is that aliyah, we don't call someone up to get the aliyah. Rather, we just have the Balkore, who's reading anyway, we don't even call him up. He will make the brechas of the Torah, he will make the blessings of the Torah, because we have this tradition that if someone else is called up, who knows what impact it can have on that person. So here also, the reason that is given is because we want to go through the entire stretch dealing with the story of the golden calf, and to make sure that the person getting the aliyah will not be hurt in any way by this, we're going to call up a lazy, because the Levim are the ones who gathered on Moshe Rabbeinu, and they were the ones who protected the monotheism that Klal Yisrael was supposed to believe in. So this way, we make sure that the first two aliyos, which cover the section before the golden calf, which we'll talk about soon, and the golden calf, which are very long sections, both of them, will be led and read by the aliyot, the people who are Kohen and Levi. And they will not be affected by this, because the Kohenim and Levim were not guilty at all in the building golden calf. Everyone else had participants in it, but not lazy and not the Kohenim. So that's the reason it is lopsided. But beginning, there are many different units here, many things to discuss. Obviously, we can't discuss everything. But in verse 11, the first idea is an idea which really we discussed a couple of weeks ago. Well, I'm not sure we discussed a couple of weeks ago because we didn't get into the mafters. But several weeks ago, we had the Shabbos called Shabbos Shkolim. That was the Shabbos for the month of Adar. And the second Sefer Torah was brought out, and we read this section of the half shekel that the Jews gave. And the Torah here talks about in verse number 12, when you will take a census of the children of Israel, count the Jews according to the counts, so then it says that each person shall give an atonement for his soul when counting them. And in this way, there will be no plague among them when counting them. And each Jew should give a half a shekel. And the ones who gave their shekels, the ones who were counted, were the people of military age, 20 and above. The wealthy should not give more, the poor should not give less. To again to serve as an atonement for your soul. Right. So Zerashi explains that what Torah is telling us is whatever you can't choose, whatever it is, don't count Jews by the head. Don't count one Jew, two, three, four, five. Rather, Rashi says, let each person give a half shekel, you count the shkolim, and then you will know the census, the number of Jews. And then Rashi says, the reason for this is, in Rashi number 12, we'll see, Shaminyan sholeit bo ayin hara, vadev bo leim. Kimosh matzina me David. That for some reason, which we really can relate to, Rashi tells us that when you count people, Jewish people, it brings the ayin hara. The ayin hara is something which it's not a logical thing. The idea of an ayin hara on a basic level is that if you're going to show off what you have, and people will look at you with a jealous eye, basically they're complaining to God and they're saying to God, you know, you apparently gave this guy a lot of mazel and bracha, and he's really not deserving. Maybe before Rosh Hashanah he might have been deserving, but the year is passing by and he's done many things inappropriate, and you are really unwittingly, or even perhaps even deliberately, asking God, you're complaining to God that there's no justice here, and therefore you're asking God for a retrial. And sometimes it can work. Sometimes it can be a retrial. That is the belief we have in Judaism, that there is this idea of an ayin hara. When you show off your success, can hurt you. And there's no question that we find this throughout the Talmud. So it's not just some sort of a crazy superstition. It is in the Talmud. It's all over the place. But at the same time, the idea that if you're going to count people, there's the ayin hara. And if you count half shekels, there's not ayin hara. That's not something which is logical. And Rashi tells us that there really were two censuses that the Torah is referring to. One census took place right after the building of the golden calf. And even the golden calf is discussed a bit later in this Torah portion. But this really refers to the census of counting the Jews, because if the Jews were killed off because of the golden calf, God wanted to have another census to show how important they are to him, the Jews, the remaining Jews are to him. So when they made that census, God says to Moshe, let them take a census by counting half shekels. Then we're going to have a bit later, after the putting of the tabernacle, which will be in the year of the second year of going out of Egypt. So again, the Jews need their shekels to give their shekels in order to make the sockets, which were silver sockets. And that's the second census. That's what Rashi says, and Rabban also says that, and not everyone agrees with that. In fact, the Vilna Gaon, the Be'er Gra, disagrees, and he says there's really only one census, not two censuses. And over here, Walter is telling his fear, not tell us there should be a census at this point. There was no census now. The census took place later after the tabernacle was put up, according to Vilna Gaon. And here, Alter is telling us, when you count people, when you make a census, just don't count people, count coins. But don't do it right now. That's what the Vilna Gaon says, and he has reasons for saying that. Based on Yerushalmi, Talmud Yerushalmi. But be it as it may, not everyone agrees that the issue here is an issue of the ayin hara, of the what we call the evil eye. There's one of the Gedolei Yisrael, his name was Moshe Chafetz, and others also who believe that the Torah is telling us something else here. The reason that it's important, but it's telling us when people do give things like half shekels, when people give donations to put up a tabernacle, the Pasuk is telling us, make sure that when it comes to something as important, as significant as sacrifices, or the foundation, that people will give equally. Because if those who don't have see others giving much more than them, it brings to jealousy, brings to division, that will bring to a negev, that will bring to the plagues, that will set into Klai Yisrael because there's a lack of unity. So that's another approach in understanding this, and that's the way Rashi learns, because of the ayin hara aspect. But if they're telling us that you're putting up a tabernacle, it's going to need sacrifices, it's going to need a foundation, make sure that everyone gives equally. Otherwise, it leads to machlokes. Yes. Numbers, yes, but we don't count people. Again, the idea of ayin hara, as I said, the idea of an ayin hara, which is related to counting people, is not something which we have any way of understanding that. What's the difference? People or shekels? I mean, ultimately, you get the number of people, you'll find out the number of people. So there's no way of understanding it that I'm familiar with anyway. So, that's the first section dealing with this mitzvah. Well, which raises the question, how is it that David HaMelech, if you go into the book of Samuel and later in the book of Kings, there it tells us that David counted people and there was a plague which killed 70,000 Jews. That's lots of Jews, tens of thousands, 70,000 Jews. That's recorded in the book of Shmuel, the book of Malachim, also the book of Kings. Now, how did King David make such a mistake? And there are different ways of looking at it. Some say that David HaMelech assumed for some reason that this concept over here only applies to the Jews in the desert, did not apply to the Jews in Israel. Others say, the Mepharshim say, that David HaMelech indeed did not count them by heads, but he counted shekels or something else, whatever it was he counted. And the reason there was a plague is because there was no need for that census. He wasn't going to war at that time. And the feeling was that, according to his Mepharshim, David just did it for reasons which were not humble reasons, reasons that perhaps bordered on some form of arrogance. And therefore, but why God was so harsh, killing 70,000 Jews, again, we can't relate to that, not in a way that Muslims can relate to. But again, the Mepharshim certainly labor in trying to understand how is it that most people here know we don't count Jews. In fact, when you're looking for minion, and you need 10, and we see 8 or 9, we say, there's a verse, Hoshea Samacha, Uvarech HaZnachonzach, Orem HaNashim HaDarelem, that's a verse, which is a famous verse, which talks about God saving the Jewish people, asking God to save us, and that verse has 10 different words to it. So we want to see if there's a minion, we say, Hoshea HaSamach, we count, not by numbers, but by shes, by that verse. So everyone knows that, and David didn't know it. And that's what everyone's searching for a different understanding as to how he made this mistake. Okay, that's the first section. And then from there we go to the next unit, which is chapter 30, verse number 17. And our chumash, which we're using by the final page 429. And the next unit deals with something, a piece of furniture in the tabernacle, which we would assume would have been mentioned during the first Torah Sedra dealing with the building of the tabernacle, which is Truma. It's not mentioned there. Unless we start pushing the Tetzava, we also have something else which we would expect in Truma, which is in Tetzava, and that's the golden altar, the incense altar. And we mentioned last week why that's mentioned Tetzava, not in Truma. But the last thing which is mentioned here is the wash basin, which is used by the Kohanim before they entered the service to wash their hands and their feet. The Kohanim was serving in the tabernacle, had to go barefoot. There should not be any what's called a chatitza, any separation between their feet and the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash. It's called a chatitza issue, separation issue. So therefore, they were nothing, and they washed their hands and feet when they began the service. So, which begs the question, this was in the courtyard of the tabernacle. Courtyard of the tabernacle had two pieces of furniture. There was a copper altar, which was basically running 24/7 with all the animal sacrifices. That was extensively used. That was in many ways the centerpiece of the tabernacle. And that was in the courtyard. We already mentioned in the tabernacle itself you had two chambers. The outer chamber, you had the incense, which is called the gold altar, menorah, and the shulchan. Inside, then you had the inner chamber, which is called the Holy of Holies, and there you had the cherubim. But outside, yeah, the copper altar, and you also had this wash basin, which, again, begs the question, why is this over here? And there's the famous story concerning this, which Rashi brings down later in Vayakhel, that when Moshe asked people to donate the valuables to the tabernacle, everyone complied, almost everyone complied. And the woman brought also, among the things they brought were their mirrors. And Moshe rejected them because saying the whole function of mirrors for vanity, and I'm not going to accept that in a holy temple. And Moshe gets a message from God, and in this message that he gets, a tweet from God telling Moshe that don't reject them, because if anything, these mirrors to me are more chashuv, more cherished than anything else. And the reason being, because the Jewish men were sent away from their wives, one of the ways that Paro was trying to deal with the problem of demographics, that the Jews are populating the country too swiftly, too quickly, was to send the Jewish men away from their wives, let them work all different areas of Egypt, and this way, without the Jewish men around, the women can't have children, obviously. But he didn't count on the determination of Jewish women to make sure they would have big families, and they followed their husbands. They were able to locate them where they were, and the husbands were just they're enslaved, and they were not interested in mating and having kids. And it was the Jewish women that took their mirrors and tried to make themselves attractive to, in a certain sense, seduce their husbands, and that's how they established the many, many multitudes of the Jewish children in Egypt. And therefore God says to Moshe Rabbeinu that this to me is more cherished than all other donations, because it was through these things which are perhaps devoted to vanity, dedicated to vanity, through which the Jewish women use it correctly to be able to make sure they'll be attracted to their husbands and they will have big families. Now there is a statement of Acharon Acharon Chaviv. The last thing is the most chushed, most important, most cherished. So even though the wash basins were used initially, at first, when you enter the tabernacle, the first thing you do, you have to wash your hands. That's number one. But it's mentioned in the last one over here, because to underscore this idea of the acharon, acharon chaviv, what is mentioned last is most chushed, most important. So that's why it's mentioned last. Now, the wash basin, the Rashba was a Rishon from the 13th and 14th century. When he talks about the wash basin, he talks about the reason why we get up in the morning, we wash our hands from a vessel, is because he tells us that since when the Kohanim entered the Beis HaMikdash and the Tabernacle, the first thing they did as preparation for the service was to wash their hands from a wash basin, from the kiyar. So every day when we get up, we have to view ourselves as if we're about to perform the service of God, which we're doing, similar to the service in the tabernacle. And therefore, we wash our hands in the morning when we get up. The Zohar has a different reason. The Zohar tells us that when a person gets up in the morning, there remains, when a person goes to sleep, during the time a person's awake, there's a balance in your body between the divine soul and what we call the anti-divine soul. So they neutralize each other. When you go to sleep, part of your divine soul leaves you, enters a different dimension of time and space, and therefore there's now an imbalance in your body, and the imbalance now is in favor of the animal soul, the forms of klipa, of impurity, contaminants, spiritual contaminants. And when you wake up in the morning, even though the balance is restored, but there still remains a residue of impurity on your fingers. And the Zohar tells us that in order to remove that, you must wash your hands from a vessel three times, alternating right, left, right, left, right, left. That's according to the Zohar. That's the only way that impurity is removed, is by alternating from right to left and right to left and right to left. According to the Rashba, the reason that has to do with service in the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore you don't have to alternate, but we do alternate because of the Zohar. Now, because in the tabernacle, the vessel that was used was a movable vessel. It's not something which is anchored in the ground. In halacha, we have what's called karka metatl. We have real estate, we have land, or anything connected to land is called land in halacha. And then we have what's called metatl, things that are movable. Chattel, which is movable. So the Rashba points out, and halacha tells us, just as in the tabernacle, you had to wash your hands from something which was not part of the ground, not connected to the ground. It was a movable vessel. In the same way, you can't just put your hands underneath a faucet and say, I'm going to put my hands three times under the faucet, and my hand is going to be now okay in terms of davening, in terms of saying God's name. Can't do that because your faucet is connected to pipes which are in the wall, which are connected to the ground. So therefore, your faucet that you have is called karka. It's called real estate, connected to real estate. That's not good. Can't have that. And that's why the only way to be able to cleanse yourself, similar to in the tabernacle where there was a movable vessel detached from the ground called a keli, and that is that's what a person has to use in order to get up in the, when you get up in the morning to wash your hands from those. You know, we know in halakha there are other areas where a person has to wash their hands. The other area is using a vessel is not as important. You can just go to the sink. When a person leaves the bathroom, a person relieves oneself, eliminates, you have to wash your hands, but there, technically you don't have to use a vessel. The only two times where you have to use a vessel are getting up in the morning and washing for hamotzi. But we also have to wash our hands anytime you touch any part of your body, which is a soiled part of your body, a sweaty part of your body, that is. You have to wash your hands. If you rub your hands on your head, on your hair, you got to wash your hands. Again, it doesn't have to be a vessel. A person takes a shower, you got to wash your hands. You can't daven, you can't say God's name without washing your hands. But again, it doesn't have to be a vessel. When a person leaves a cemetery, you have to wash your hands. That already custom is to use a vessel. Husband and wife have intimacy, they must use a vessel before they have and after they have. So there are several examples where a vessel should be used. Again, the most essential places, though, where a vessel's got to be used, that's essential, would have to do with getting up in the morning and washing before hamotzi. So that's this section. Next section. Okay. Third section. Third unit. Would be on chapter 30, verse number 22, page 431 in the Chumash which we are using. Where the Torah talks about the perfumed olive oil that is used in consecrating vessels in the tabernacle, and in fact used in consecrating the Kohanim and inducting them into their service. The idea, we've talked previously about olive oil. In the Beis Hamikdash, the two liquids that we used were olive oil and wine. There were wine libations, which we discussed last week, which accompanied sacrifices. Chazal pointed out that if you take shem and zayit, take olive oil, and you mix it with any other liquid, the olive oil will always flow to the top. Flow to the top, that is. And that represents a certain transcendency. Whereas most other liquids, if you blend them, will blend together. Olive oil won't. And will always, again, flow to the top, remain on the top. And therefore, Chassidus explains that olive oil represents that transcendency, transcendent nature of God, and of the fact, and of the neshama that we have, that in the Chassidus, you talk about those levels of God that become intermingled in life and those levels of God that remain transcendent. There's a certain part of our neshama which remains transcendent. That's called, there's certain parts of our soul when we sin, certain parts of our soul are contaminated. There are other parts of our soul which is called the keser part of our soul, the crown of our soul, which all the king's horses and all the king's men can contaminate. When a person gets up in the morning, even before we wash our hands, before washing hands, we can't make a bracha. We can't make any blessing. But we say a modam yofanacha. Malachai v'kayam. We say an entire verse thanking God for the neshama which is yourself. We do this before we've washed our hands. And the Chassidus explains because there is a certain part of the soul called the keser of the soul, the modani of the soul, which can't be contaminated. And therefore, even though we haven't washed our hands, we say that before washing our hands, modani. And that's the idea of olive oil. Olive oil is something which flows to the top, that transcendent force within God, within us. And when we want to consecrate the vessels of the tabernacle, the Torah tells us we have to smear it with this perfumed olive oil. Whether it's the vessels or whether it's the Kohen himself, we do that. Next section. And that is, would be in chapter 30, verse 34, in our Chumash, page 435, where the Torah talks about the most powerful sacrifice of all the sacrifices, which is the incense sacrifice. We talked about it last week, because last week's Torah portion of the Tzavah talked about the golden altar, which was the incense altar. As I just said before, the copper altar on the outside, where the animals were sacrificed, were copper altar, that is, was in operation almost 24/7. But the incense altar was only used twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And we sacrificed the 11, there were 11, according to Rashi, Rashi explains, there were 11 ingredients. And these are the most powerful tools of the tabernacle. We'll find a bit later when Korach, the third portion of Korach, when he challenged the authority of Moshe, and he also suggests that he wants to be the Kohen Gadol, shouldn't be Aaron. And Moshe says, you know what, there can only be one Kohen Gadol, and I'm going to challenge all of you, because he, Korach, as you know, had 250 collaborators with him. And he said, I'm going to ask all of you to take a incense sacrifice. And I'm warning you, only one will survive, because the incense sacrifice is the most dangerous and powerful of all the sacrifices. And they accepted the challenge, they all died. So we find that the incense sacrifice was both a tonic for curing, we find also later, but we find that another Nadiva, Aaron's sons, also died with the incense sacrifice. So it was very powerful stuff. And according to Hasidus and Kabbalah, there are 11 different ingredients. We talk about the 10 sfirot, the 10 holy sfirot of Kiddush, of holiness, corresponding to the 11 sfirot of anti-divinity. We know that there is, we've talked about many times, we have a whole field of, a divine field of Kiddush, and then we have what's called the field of Klipa, Klipas Noga, Klima Klipos. What's the forces of anti-divinity? And whereas Kedusha is broken down into the 10 different attributes, beginning with wisdom, ending with Malchus, Kabbalah talks about the 11 different spherot of anti-divinity. And therefore, the sacrifice of the incense, the 11 different ingredients, were there to serve as a counterweight against the forces of anti-divinity, and therefore they have to be very powerful to serve as this counterweight. What's interesting is that one of the 11 ingredients, the Gemara tells us, is called the Chelbina. I think it's called in English, called the Onyx, I think. I might be wrong. But it's called the Chelbina, and the Gemara tells us that the Chelbina was odious, had a negative smell to it. Which raises the question, here we're talking about the most powerful of sacrifices, which was offered only twice a day. Why would the Torah include an ingredient which was odious, which had a bad smell to it? And the word tells us to deliver a message to us that when you offered the incense sacrifice, you were asking for God's help and God's redemption and God's salvation. And God says, in order for me to save you, I want to see tolerance on your part. And if you're willing to come during fast days and pray to me and accept in your community, even people who seem to be odious and people who you just don't care for because you feel they have certain severe character flaws, and you'd rather they shouldn't be part of your community, and you discourage them to become part of the community because you want to have a community only of spiritual people, holy people. Well, God says, the Rosh Hashanah says, that if you can't tolerate someone who seems to be odious, then you can't expect me to respond to you. because what I need from people is tolerance. So every community, every shul has to have what they call their chelvin, their stinker, so to say. And that's important. Not to try to just have a congregation where you're going to reject people who have certain questionable character traits. That's the message, the lesson that the Gemara teaches us. The sacrifice of the incense was so powerful in a positive sense that the tradition was anyone who offered it, any Kohen who offered this, would ultimately would gain wealth. And therefore one could not do this more than one time in their life. And in fact, there is a custom that we have as Jews. One of the greatest honor we can give a person who is making a bris milah, circumcision, is for the person holding the bris when the circumcision takes place. He's called the sandik. So the Medrash tells us the sandik takes the place of the incense altar. He's holding the baby. So his legs, his lap is like the incense altar, and the baby is on the incense altar. So just like when it comes to incense, we did not give it to a Kohen more than one time in his life. So usually when a person makes a bris, you try to honor your parents, usually to do it, be the sandik. It doesn't have to be the way, usually that's the custom. But your father can't be sandik more than one time for the family, that's it. Just as the incense altar, the custom was that the Kohen only did it one time in his life, that was it. This is custom, it's not Jewish law, but that's the custom. Only every family, one person will do it per family, and that's if he's done it, if the next child, the second, third, or fourth, or fifth boy, whatever it is, you'll have to get each time someone else to be the sandik. In this Zohar, the Zohar talks about the importance, since the incense sacrifice curse was so powerful. So we know that when we, part of the davening, we say, is the incense part of the davening, where we say the different ingredients for the incense. And in fact, by Nusach Sfarad or Nusach Hari, we say two times. We say it before, in the beginning of davening, we say it later by Vein Pelikeinu. Two times we say it. So the Zohar says that anyone who wants to be protected from any negative things happening around you during the day, make sure to say the incense section with kavana, with intention, with precision, articulate it correctly. Because the Zohar in the Sukkotis talks about how powerful saying this is in blocking any sort of a negative forces that can hurt you during the day. So that's an important thing for all of us to know, to say this, say it correctly. Okay, so that's the next thing. As I said, there are a lot of sections here. And the next section is chapter 31, verse number 1, which in our Chumash should be page 439. And here is where God says to Moshe that I have called on Bezalel, the son of Uri, the grandson of Hur, to be in charge of everything going on in building a tabernacle. And God says, I filled them with the Spirit of God, with wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And why was Bezalel chosen? He was a young man. According to the Medrash, he was only 12 years old. And he was the, call him the Leonardo da Vinci of his time, or Michelangelo of his time. There is in Israel today, there is a school for art called the Bezalel School for Art. Right? Rachel, is am I correct? There's a Bezalel School for Art, which is, I think, number one there in Israel in terms of art. And because he was the top artist, he was a tzaddik, and he also had a very interesting merit, which, you know, God gives us different honors in life and different jobs, confers upon us different responsibilities based on our actions, and many times also the merit of parents and grandparents. Well, he was the grandson of Hur, and his great-grandmother, Hur, was a son of Miriam, who was Moshe Rabbeinu's sister. And one of Bezalel's great merits, the fact that it mentions here the grandfather, usually the Torah identifies a person saying who he is and who his father is. Here the Torah says who he was, his father was Uri, and grandfather was Hur. Why mention Hur? Well, very important, because a bit later, very soon, the Torah will talk about, as we said, the building of the golden calf. And Rashi brings down from the Medrash that when Moshe tarried, or they thought there was a miscommunication between Moshe and the Jewish people, they thought he was supposed to come down a day earlier. And when Moshe did not, so that, as we know, he made a golden calf, and there was one person who stood up against the Jews, and that was Hur. And he was blood and guts. He stood up, and he was gunned down. He was killed. So the Jews killed him. It's not sure the Jews, the Abraham, but he was killed. And in fact, Hur would be the first martyr that Torah talks about. We know that Avram was thrown into the fiery furnace, but he survived. The first martyr that Torah ever talks about would be Hur, who was Miriam's grandson, great-grandson. I'm sorry. Hur was the son of Miriam, and Bezalel was the great-grandson of Miriam. And so his merit was that he stood up to the Jews, and therefore, and he got killed. Not all time did the good guys win. Here we have the first case that, according to the history of Torah, that is, where the good guy didn't win. The good guy stood up, but he did get killed. And that's when God ultimately says, we'll make a tabernacle. And because it was Uri stood up to the Jews then, Chos-Hur stood up to the Jews, therefore Bezalel will be the one who will be endowed. He had his own righteousness, on tzidkis. He was a saint, he was a righteous person, that is, a tzaddik. But on top of that, he wasn't the only tzaddik. On top of that, he had the merit that his grandfather gave up his life with this. That's the next section. Then we go to chapter 31, verse number 12, 13, 14, where God says to Moshe, and you speak to the Jews of Israel, saying, just observe my Shabbos for a sign between me and you for your generations, know that I am Hashem who sanctifies you. So Rashi says in verse number 13, and you shall speak to the children of Israel, and you, although I have charged you to command them concerning the work of the Mishkan, do not view things so lightly as to push aside the Shabbos because of that work. And that's what God says to Moshe. You might have thought that you can even violate the Shabbos to put up the tabernacle. And God says, that you can't do. You shall observe the Shabbos, because this is a sign between me and the Jewish people. Os beinivim ben Yisrael os ilyolam. It's an everlasting sign, an eternal sign. In one of his discourses, the Rebbe says, why would you think that you should violate Shabbos for the tabernacle? Why would you think tabernacle is so important? If they're all mitzvahs are important, why would tabernacle be different? When it comes to other mitzvahs also, you don't violate Shabbos for another mitzvah. And the Rebbe tells us the following reason. In the next third portion of Vayakhel, which talks where Moshe gathers the Jews and tells the Jews about, up until now we have God speaking to Moshe, telling him about building a tabernacle. And then we have, in chapter 35, verse number 1, page 488, this is Moshe gathers now all the Jews and tells them about the Shabbos and about building a tabernacle. But it's Vayakhel. Vayakhel means he gathered all them together. When it comes to the other mitzvos, God gave Moshe the other mitzvos, and he taught the Jewish people. When it comes to building a tabernacle, we find that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the Jews directly and taught the Jews all the mitzvahs of building a tabernacle. If you look in in our Chumash, again, chapter 34, verse number 32, on page 484, Rashi tells us, on page 44, Acha Shalom and Luzkein, if Moshe taught the Torah to all the elders, he would repeat it to Klal Yisrael. And Rashi continues, he brings the Braisa, Moshe first studied from God the Torah, and then he taught it to Aaron, and after teaching the entire Torah to Aaron, so then he taught it to, then Moshe taught the Torah to Aaron's children, number two, and they would, after that, they left, they stayed there, but they were moved from the beginning, from the middle of the room, and then Moshe taught it to the elders, and then they moved to the side, and then he taught it to the rest of the Jewish people. So Moshe taught the Torah four times. First to Aaron, then to Aaron's sons. Aaron remained in the room, but he moved to the side. Then to the elders, and then to the Jewish people. So all the Jewish people heard from Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah one time, and Aaron heard four times. And Aaron's children heard three times directly from Moshe. So that's when it comes to the rest of the Torah. When it comes to building a tabernacle, God says to Moshe, I want you to teach the Torah directly to the Jews all four times. Directly from you. So therefore the Rebbe says, that's what the Rebbe says. He says, because when it comes to building a tabernacle, apparently it was so significant where God says to Moshe, I don't want you to do it the regular way of teaching Aaron four times and the rest of the people three times, two times, one time. I want you to teach all the Jewish people four times. That's Rebbe's understanding. The reason that one would have thought, that Moshe would have thought, that perhaps building the tabernacle overrides Shabbos is because this is special and that it was taught directly from Moshe and Jews four times. And by the way, from here we see the importance of reviewing something at least four times. Because they'll tell us this. Because as I said, Moshe taught four times and the Jews heard from Moshe one time, but they heard from the elders and from Aaron, ultimately, they all learned it four times. So it's important, you know, many times people learn things, and they don't have time to review, and that's not a good thing. So therefore, the Rebbe explains, that's why Moshe thought, God told Moshe, no, even though the Mishkan is special, and has to be taught by you four times to all the Jewish people, nevertheless, it's not so special that you violate the Shabbos for this. Okay, that is the first up to Sheni. The next section deals with the debacle of the golden calf, and it's certainly very difficult to be able to relate to this idea that the Jews would build the golden calf after experience God at Mount Sinai some 40 days beforehand, and there was a misunderstanding between God, between Moshe and the Jewish people as to when he's coming down. Misunderstanding, that can happen, but why would they go ahead and build the golden calf? And there were ultimately 3,000 Jews out of 600,000 would be this, which is less than 1%. But still, even 3,000. And the fact that the other Jews did not intervene or protest, the only one who really protested, we said, was Hur. That was it. And it has happened. So the Gemara tells us, according to the oral tradition, that indeed this shouldn't have happened. There's no logical reason for this to happen. But sometimes, the Gemara tells us, God pushes us into a certain situation for important reason. The Gemara says, the reason for this, that God, in a certain sense, pushed us into this, was to send a message to the generation that will come from Klal Yisrael, that a person can be on a very high spiritual level, like the views of Mount Sinai, and tumble and suffer a precipitous spiritual drop, like it's used here with the building golden calf. And then we have the wherewithal and the ability to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps and to repent, which we did. And we know the first Yom Kippur came about because of this sin. That Moshe Rabbeinu will come down 40 days after going to Mount Sinai, and the Jews come down on the 17th of Tammuz, and he'll kill out those Jews who are guilty. And the 19th, he goes back up and he says, 40 days, begging God for forgiveness, and God will forgive the Jews after 40 days, but wants the Jews to continue the process of Tshuva for the next 40 days, which is the last 40 days, beginning the first day of El and ending on Yom Kippur, when God will finally say, "So lasti gitvarecha, I will forgive the Jewish people per your request." So according to the Gemara, it was a setup. We believe in the old tradition, and that's what the old tradition teaches us. This was a setup in order to serve as a message and a lesson to Klal Yisrael. When I talk about an oral tradition, I'd like to share with you an important idea where, towards the end of Kisisa, God says, Ki alpi advarim ha'ela. Let me try to find it. I don't have the Rashi in front of me, but there's a Rashi in this week's Sedra where God talks about Kialpi Advar Ma'el according to these words, where Rashi says that, okay, we got it here. In chapter, page, what is it, chapter 34, verse number 27, it's on page 43. God says to Moshe, "Ksov l'cha Advar Ma'el, write for yourself these words. According to these words, I have entered the covenant with you and with Yisrael." So Rashi says, "Ksav lecha es advar me'el." Write these things down, which is the written tradition, the scriptures. V'lo atu v'shal lach l'tov tashvatem. But the oral tradition should not be written down. Now we don't have today an oral tradition at all. Everything is written down, and the reason for that is because in the end of the 2nd century, when the Jews saw that the Roman noose was getting tighter and tighter, and the Romans were out to destroy Yiddishkeit, the yeshivas, the rabbis were convinced unless they took the oral tradition and they committed it to writing, it would be lost forever. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, beginning at the end of the 2nd century, who arrogated to himself the right to take the oral tradition and put it together in what are called the Mishnayos, the six different fields of Mishnah. I mentioned before in one of his books, Rabbi Zalman Margolyes, I'm sorry, Rabbi Reuven Margolyes, who died around 45 years ago, was a great scholar. And he brings the Maamar Chazal, the statement from the rabbis, that it's worded a little different than Rashi, a little differently than Rashi, that is. And where he says, "Dvarim Shebalpeh, Yatar Shalom of Uksav," which means things that were given over orally should not be said from written documents. And he shows very clearly that people always wrote down notes for themselves. Rabbis, when they heard a lecture, always wrote down notes. And therefore, when Rashi tells us that you can't write down the Tosh Bal Peh, what Rashi really means to say is that when people gave lectures, they had no notes. The lectures that you gave from the oral tradition were given orally. But in terms of students writing their own notes, he shows very convincingly, Rabbi Margolyes does, that the rabbis always had notes. That's the issue is, Varm Shalpeh Yata Rasholom B'Ksav, you can't give lectures from written notes, but people always have written notes. So therefore it's important to know that when we talk about an oral tradition, it's not as if Jews didn't write down things, they always wrote down things. But as I said, in terms of giving lectures, until the end of the 2nd century, people who gave a lecture in Torah always had to give it by heart, commit it from memory. And as Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who started a tradition of giving lectures from written material, and that constituted a major revolution, and he felt that unless this would be done, he based it on the pasuk in Tehillim, "Eis la'asos la'Hashem eferet ha'asecha," which means at certain times, in order to sustain a relationship with God, for the sake of God, sometimes the Torah got to be violated. And that's a very, very dangerous statement. That's a pasuk though. It's a dangerous issue because it can lead to a slippery slope. I'm very careful how we use that, but he based it on that pasuk in Tehillim, chapter 119. Again, Eis Lasos LaHashem. When we're trying to do something for God, Hefer HaTorasecha, we have a right to violate the Torah. And Rabbi Yonasi said that during that period of Jewish and Roman history, in the end of the second century, was a time already, time was right to now begin a new phase in teaching Torah and having books printed and people, official books and scrolls, and delivering lectures from those scrolls and studying the scrolls. And that was looked upon as a turning point in Jewish history. And a person, Latzadik Rabbi Yonasi, was the first leader of the Jews then, and he also had, he was very wealthy, the wealthy Jew of his time. He had the ability, not only was a tzaddik and a scholar and of genius, but he was wealthy enough to be able to bankroll this entire job, this entire project, because he had to have tens of thousands of scribes, because there were no printing presses, obviously. It was all done by hand. So he had to have thousands and thousands of writers to do this, and he bankrolled it. But that's all based on this pasuk on page 483, chapter 34, verse number 27. Any questions? It says it was a golden calf, which Rashi says had life to it. It was able to walk. What do you mean by a cherub? I guess there's an opinion out there like that. Okay, we'll continue next week.